Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with Ian Alden Russell of the David Winton Bell Gallery at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. We're talking about their Works Well With Others exhibition, which goes until June 12th. Enjoy! So, who is John C. Gonzalez, and what sort of experience does he have working with Well With Others?
John is a native from Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay.
So he's from here. He now lives out in Lincoln, Rhode Island, and he did a couple of years in New York in between. But he was born in Providence, ended up being a local boy going to the Rhode Island School of Design, and later went on to the museum school at the MFA, which is now part of Tufts University up in Boston.
Right.
So he's a Rhode Islander. And so we're coming into the summer here, so he is our, if you will, our regional focus for this year.
Cool.
And John, trained as an illustrator, but also as a painter and a draftsman. Mm-hmm. And he has that career in those mediums in their own right.
Right.
But in parallel to that work, he's been doing a collaborative art projects, participatory art projects. And that's how I first got to know him. I was invited by then curator at the DeCorva Sculpture Park in Lincoln, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Her name's Lexi Lee Sullivan. Lexi Lee did a rather interesting thing for the 2013 DeCordova Biennial, where that's sort of the, in effect, the New England Biennial.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bring in artists from all over the region. And her decision was for the catalog to invite curators from all of the towns or cities where the artists from the region were coming to show work. She asked those curators to meet with those artists, get to know them, and then write essays on their work. And so it kind of broadened out the curatorial perspective. And so I had the great fortune of being able to meet John because he was a Providence artist. And he was doing this rather amazing project called the Home Depot House. And Home Depot House emerged from John trying to reconcile his necessary job working in retail at Home Depot store in Providence with, you know, his career and his desire to make art. And he didn't necessarily feel comfortable accepting the sort of art work or art job separation or binary. And he wanted to see, I wonder how we might be able to sort of undercut that. And you know, John had been doing participatory art projects for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so at Home Depot House, for the first time, he was able to really widen out and collaborate with all of the other employees in Home Depot's authorized by Home Depot, their main corporate offices, meaning they had permission to do this. And so during their work hour, the technicians, the employees at Home Depot worked together to build a small cabin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Inside the store, and then they brought that cabin from Providence to the DeCordova Sculpture Park and Museum for the biennial.
Uh-huh.
And so this cabin set was placed on the ground and was there for a year, so during the biennial, but then also beyond the biennial, and it served as a studio space for what was a local or regional artist residency program.
Oh, neat.
And so, yeah, it's rather special. So John was the named artist for the biennial, but his decision was to collaborate with the employees in the store and then to create a platform and space for more artists to be able to work and share. And that's sort of one of the things that John's very interested in. He's sort of self-styles himself as a post-critical artist.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I sort of have come to think about it is, in the 1980s in particular, many artists were exploring institutional critique in order to push against the dominant establishment, the art establishment. And John, not that he disagrees with that, but he's interested in, if you will, institutional complements.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, additions to, building onto. So understanding that their structures have problems, but rather than focusing on just trying to critique the problems, he wants to create situations for more people to participate in making things. And that process itself will start to reveal and point at both the problems, but also perhaps different ways of approaching work within an institution. So the title for this show, Works Well With Others, brings some examples, a documentation of the Home Depot house, into a group showing of about seven different projects that John has done over the last, I guess it's 8 years, mm-hmm. All exploring collaborative and participatory art making.
Right. I think anyone will be able to relate to this because, I mean, who doesn't work with others, well or otherwise? But, I mean, hopefully we work well, but oftentimes we don't. And those experiences stand out in our heads probably more.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I think John is implicit within John's work and why he's so passionate about this is that all of us are dependent upon each other,
right.
In various ways, and that although, if you will, the American story is one of independence, speaking for myself editorially,
right.
I might say that America is equally a story of dependence.
Right.
It was dependence on slave labor, dependence on domestic labor, dependence on friends and family. The list would go on and on. And
mm-hmm.
Rather than try to make claims towards radical independence, is actually
right.
to embrace the fact that we are always working with each other to sustain and make possible an institution or
right.
A series of interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
And so John's projects gesture towards the fundamental collaborative or dependent nature of life.
Right, exactly.
yeah.
Exactly. I've had so many experiences where I can totally relate. It was so cool. It was funny. I was looking at found a picture online, the one about, what's it called? Family meal. And I wasn't sure I found the right picture. So I was like, that's not a family. So I didn't understand what was going on, but then I researched it a little more and I didn't realize that, I never worked in restaurants. I work at Starbucks, but I've worked in food service, but I've not worked in restaurants. I didn't realize that they did, I didn't realize they called that family meal, and that's what they did. I thought that was kind of an education to me, and I thought it was really interesting.
Oh, that's good, John. That would make John smile. This is one of the things I think that John also tries to do is to, approach and make visible the quality and culture of other people's workplaces, and as far as possible, not to simply represent it, which might be exploitative. And you might say just the appropriating a person to represent a type of labor,
mm-hmm.
but really trying to understand what those situations are and try to open that up to others to participate in. So in the case of family meal. And I should say that Family Meal emerged as a commission by the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston that has taken very seriously over the last few years collecting and supporting performance art.
Uh-huh.
So it's an interesting, elegant challenge. How does one collect or show performance art?
Yeah.
Particularly after it's happened.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
This program of performance art events was called Odd Spaces. And so John's contribution was to work with the Bravo restaurant and then the Garden Cafeteria, so the eatery
uh-huh.
within the museum. And every single day, the chefs have to not only develop or conceptualize a menu for the guests, the diners, but they also have to figure out something they're going to feed themselves and their quote-unquote family, right?
Uh-huh.
So the other employees. And it's kind of this, lesser known, or unless you work in restaurants or, food service, the restaurant, in which case you're very familiar, but
mm-hmm.
with family meals, or sometimes they're called shift meals. And it's sort of two parts to that. One is obviously the way that, I mean, I think the title family will get to the point that teams or people who work together, you know, for 8, 10, 12 hours a day, that there is a familial interdependence there.
Right.
And so it's called, you know, familial, but then the other part is when you step into that moment of making a family and whatnot, often you appeal to what are really core, you know, simple foods that you enjoy and you would like, you make for each other, you share for each other. Mm-hmm. And so the chefs also appealed a little bit to the other version or meaning of a family meal, being foods that they may have grown up eating or they ate with other people that they considered their family.
Right.
And so opening that up to the visitors or the diners, you know, it kind of, in some ways, I think the hope was that that would extend the experience, the exchange, and the sense of connectivity and familial feelings within the kitchen staff out through the entire restaurant. Because often, you know, there's a lot of restaurants is that barrier where the kitchen is utterly, you never see those people, you don't experience what they're experiencing, yet you appreciate all of the things that come out of
right.
that kitchen. And so I think family meal is an attempt for John to make a small, subtle gesture that was in collaboration with others to open up the possibility for others to experience and participate within that that little moment that happens in every kitchen in America every day.
Yeah, yeah. So do they all eat at the same time? Or do they all, like the workers that at the family meal, or do they just eat like individually? I don't quite understand that yet.
I'll have to appeal to my own life experience working in restaurants. I would say every restaurant would be slightly different, but in my experience, that it would usually, you would either, I guess more traditionally, is you would eat early. So uh-huh. let's say dinner service starts at 6 or 7, you know, you're eating at like 5:30,
right?
So it's like it's the fuel to get you through.
Yeah.
Sometimes it might happen late, but you know, more often than not, at the end of service,
mm-hmm.
You're just cleaning up and wanting to get out there.
Right,
out
right, there. Exactly.
So traditionally, I think it's more of like a meal that you want to eat before going into the full dinner service.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's really interesting. That's cool. We on my breaks, we all have different breaks, and we just have, you know, we just grab what we can get, and
uh-huh.
not necessarily like a community type meal. But yeah, so I thought that was really interesting.
Well, it's kind of important. I mean, actually, now that you say that, it makes me reflect also in my more recent work life, which is, you know, a lot of offices these days, people are pushing to get a lot of work done, so people can't take lunch at the same time.
Right.
You know, so there's always, you know, people who have to be in the office. It's only for a time, and inevitably, you go out and you want, you know, you want to see your friends, you want to see other people,
mm-hmm.
or you have a working lunch. And meaning that it isn't necessarily the case that, you know, all the people who sustain an organization will stop with each other in the middle of the day mm-hmm. or in the middle of work and have a meal together. And I think that that's something that is sort of special about this idea of the family meal, that it is a time where the staff stops. Generally, it isn't always the case, but generally you stop and you
right.
and you therefore are sitting with each other and you're talking, mm-hmm. whatever it is you feel like, you know, yeah. sharing or experiencing. And that idea of how food brings people together.
Yeah.
And that's where this, that project, I don't think it was intentionally conceived as such, but really gestures towards some of the increasing popularity of food-based
yeah.
making, food-based art
mm-hmm.
that's appearing in within contemporary art over the last 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, who doesn't like food?
Right, absolutely. It's a very, very easy thing to share.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very cool. What I wasn't able to find a image of collaborative garden. What's that like?
Okay. Well, there will be one online shortly because our cabinet installation shop is coming in. But the collaborative garden, if you could conjure in your mind, you come into a gallery space, it's a blank white cube.
Mm-hmm.
And you move around one wall into a new space, and as you do so, you just start to see, you know, little flashes of green.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say that while you're moving into the gallery space, it feels warmer, it feels a little moist, and the air is slightly thicker with smell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, and most of us familiar with it, it's like the smell of mulch, right? You know,
yeah,
a bit of pininess or cedar or that sort of feeling.
Right. How do you do that? How do you accomplish that?
Well, I was sort of trying to do a poetic kind of storytelling there, but...
I'm sorry, go ahead. Finish. I'm sorry.
I'm on the wall in the center of the garden. The center of the gallery is a large garden, you know, roughly... 20 feet by 30 feet. It's not strictly, you know, geometric. It's more of an organic form.
Uh-huh.
But there's two large bluffs that are effectively mulch mounds that are also covered by moss.
Uh-huh.
And throughout those bluffs are ferns, are some shrubs, some red reptile dogwoods, some rhododendron. There's two river birch trees. There's a small fir tree, and then various other like low-lying grasses, low-light plants. That's obviously the sort of crucial thing for it to survive in the gallery. And then in the middle is a fountain, a water feature that starts at the top of one of the bluffs and comes down the side of it into a small pool.
Uh-huh.
And down the center of it is a gravel path. And what the, if you were to come into experience it, what John wants you to have, hopefully, is a moment of calm, a moment of meditation, personal reflection, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, it references a very important period in his life where he was very sick. And he was in New York, and he found solace in a public garden that had a water feature in it. And that place, that space, was a very important part for him getting well again.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to make a garden, but he wanted to do that with other people. And mm-hmm. so what came out of the process is we brought John in to work with a landscaping firm called Belterra, which is was contracted with Brown University to do a lot of the landscaping on campus. And in particular, they do a lot of the special manicuring around our public artworks that are on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sort of taken by this community of workers who, at least certainly from like the public relations side of the university, are unknown, right? They are paid by the university, but their names, their authorship,
right,
if you will, for how the campus takes form and how it looks, is only known insofar as the company named Belterra is known.
Right.
And so we, John had conversations with Phil Taylor, who's the supervisor who helps us here at Brown University, and then with Pamela Rogers, who's a garden designer, and so she's done a lot of consulting for indoor gardens. We needed somebody to make sure that we bring plants indoors and not kill them, so Pam helped us be successful, and the result was we figured out a materials-led seasonal plants that would divide a general working principle for how we're going to keep the plant alive. And then the Belterra team came in to the gallery over about 4 to 5 days and were working on figuring out how the garden should take form.
Yeah.
And so it was very much a collaborative process, if you will. I mean, there were certain directed elements from the artist, from John, that... But was really John in conversation with Phil and in conversation and collaboration with Pam that, if you will, set the team up for success. And so they sort of, if you will, established a template for the garden. And then it really was a collaborative, creative realization in the center of the gallery that has once again transformed our gallery space into something completely different, which has been rather wonderful. And I also would just say that I have opportunity to acknowledge it. It's transformed my job because, you know, rather than coming into the gallery in the morning and turning on the lights and, you know, looking, I mean, we do turn on the lights, we look at the condition of works, all those things.
Right.
Now I spend half an hour to an hour a day gardening.
Watering the plants. Is that in your job description?
Maintaining the artwork.
I guess so.
And it can be interpreted in lots of ways. And it, you know, be honest, it wasn't, I didn't initially think about that. I was much more concerned about supporting John and supporting the project and supporting the process and making sure everybody was feeling, you know, comfortable with the project, that they were being fairly treated and that they were participating in a healthy way. It wasn't until everything was up and the opening has happened and everybody is off doing other things, I realized, like, wait a second, all right. Oh, okay, I guess I'm gardening for, eight weeks. But that's been kind of wonderful, and it's sort of this unexpected, collaboration or participatory element that we had not sort of originally special. And I just want to just say, well, I'll say to acknowledge to the people who worked on Collaborative Garden, apart from John, was Juan Reyes, Pamela Rogers, Chudin Sanchez, Philip Taylor, and Chudin Askett. So that was our team of six people who turned our gap into a garden.
Cool. That's awesome. I bet that's very different and very just an interesting change in the workplace, in the workspace. I mean, you're used to having, like, you know, beautiful art around, I'm sure, but it's just, a garden is just something special and something different.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, you go into, traditionally these days, you know, you go into a museum or a gallery space, it's climate controlled.
Right.
So there's just enough humidity so the works are safe. It's just cool enough to get the works are safe. So there's sort of like this, there are operational parameters, like, you know, best practices for humidity and temperature and light and all that sort of things for any galleries. And so the result of that is, if you are a museum goer, you get used to the temperature and humidity of those spaces. And so what's kind of interesting about doing this show is a garden shifts it. Like, you know, and in the same way, an insulation piece that might involve water or any organic matter, it will shift those conditions.
Right.
And at a minimum, it, like, the olfactory sensation, having smell in the gallery, it changes things, and it definitely shifts the way you may be interpreting or appreciating, even if it's just in a very subliminal, subconscious way. It shifts kind of how the gallery feels.
Right.
And I think that's been a really fun experience for us working at a gallery with the show.
Yeah. Well, and you said that you were able to achieve the kind of a mulchy smell and just kind of you said working with the temperature, I guess, would change the temperature, obviously. But I mean, but how do you achieve the mulchy smell and the whole sensation of being in a garden?
That's actually pretty simple, which is just when you're watering it, when mulch gets wet, it's pungent.
Oh, okay.
So we have to water every day, and if you know any folks who've done landscaping work and have worked with mulch, as soon as that stuff gets wet, it'll smell like the wood that it's made out of. Like,
right.
Sometimes it could be pine, it could be cedar, it could be cypress. There's a whole bunch of woods that are used to make mulch.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one we went with was cypress.
Oh.
I think. And so it has a pungency, but it's not like cedar.
Okay.
Which has a much, much, much more thicker smell. But it's enough, and it's kind of soft. And that's where, again, Pamela's advice was really helpful, because she could help make a very informed decision about, like, if you take a bunch of wood and put it in space, these are the ones that will be too much, and these are the ones that are on the better end.
Yeah.
She's not the guy, got good. And that's, again, with any type of art making, when you're working on new commissions or with a new project with an artist, it's so important to have external advice, in regard, particularly people with expertise.
Exactly.
And so these projects inevitably are collaborative, even if it's not acknowledged. There's always collaborative consultancy throughout a project like that.
Right. Well, I think all work is collaborative. I mean, whether people want to say they did it all themselves, they got input, they got something from other people. It's not entirely it's not entirely independent. So
absolutely, and that's one of the sort of core intentions and ethics of this show is that every single object on display is every single work is given its own label and attributed to who made it, or the individual or the groups of individuals that work on it. And what's very important about that is there's certain pieces that have multiple works in it, shall we say, like the gestures as part of a project called Oil Paintings for Export that was exploring the painting companies in Dafan, China, which is this city in the sort of southeastern portion of China where a lot of the oil painting reproductions are produced, and you know, the exceptionally skilled oil painters work there like long hours making these paintings. You know, they're paid at their job and whatnot, but they're again largely anonymous. And John first became interested in that situation back in 2009 because he was at AC Moore, which is like it's just a retail store, but like retail art supply.
Right. Like a binder.
It had all these paintings of daffodils, little bundles of daffodils.
Uh-huh.
And he was in the medium school at the MFA and was, you know, studying painting. And he looked at these and he was very clear to him that every daffodil painting was different and that some of them were different people's hands. And he was like, are these, you know, is this like hundreds and hundreds of daffodils painted by one person and they just want to try to change it up? Mm-hmm. Or are there hundreds and hundreds of people having to paint daffodils?
Mm-hmm.
And Corbis, he just, I don't know. I just know that it's true that there are different artistic gestures being made.
Right.
And he was concerned about who those people were. So he bought 100 of those, and that's something he exhibits as a work that's anonymous, like it's unattributable.
Right.
And
that's interesting.
His next gesture was he then commissioned one of those painting companies to have one of their painters paint, quote, paint the room that you are in while you are working on this painting, end quote.
Huh.
And the result is it's a painting of the studio where a number of painters are working on other paintings. And so you see an artist's view of his colleagues in the painting studio working on these other paintings that they won't necessarily be, wouldn't necessarily be attributed to them.
Right.
And then sort of moved by that, John was having conversations with Winnie Wong, who's an art historian now at Berkeley, who was at Harvard at the time, and he helped forge some like stronger conversations and relationships with people there, and they, John was able to go to another company and commission 50 painters to each paint a 4-inch swatch of their favorite color, and then to write what that color meant to them, and this is where this sort of project shifted. They signed them. All of the painters signed the canvases.
Mm-hmm.
And from Winnie's perspective, Winnie has studied these artists' companies, these painting companies, these artist communities. That's visual. And so there's certainly something was being, there was a decision to declare authorship. Whether that was to satisfy a Western audience, or whether that was to say this is my work, or whether it was to say that I want this to be visible, we can't know. But we just know that there was a shift.
Yeah.
And so then the final gesture that John did is he went back to that company and then commissioned 50 of the artists to paint their self-portrait. So now in the lobby space of our gallery, as you come in, you see 100 unknown paintings of daffodils, about 100 paintings of daffodils by unknown artists, a painting of a studio of where other artists are painting other work, 50 favorite colors, and 50 self-portraits.
Yeah.
And it's this beautiful sort of gesture towards visibility of, you know, people who are sustaining art markets. They're creating the beautiful objects that surround us every day, and you know, to the ethics of authorship, and then I guess you know, doffing his hat again to collaboration. You know, this John really was more of just the commissioner, and that as opposed to the artist, to debate those terms, and that this work is very much work, and so this is a long way to come around to the every single one of the campuses is attributed to whoever we can attribute those works to. So rather than showing 52 self-portraits and attributing it to John, there's 52 self-portraits attributed to the artist who painted them. And that's a logic that carries through the entire show. And so we really like to think about this, you know, John's agency, his work has brought all of these projects together, has brought these people together, but really right now, out in the gallery, we're showing the work of approximately 200 artists, which is sort of rather amazing that, you know, there's an artist who's dedicating a part of his career to opening up shows to feature the work, the authorship, and the art of other artists.
Right, right. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't speak too much for John in regards to, you know, his feelings about ethnicity and identification. But what I do know, what he told me, was a lovely story, which is that his father had immigrated from Puerto Rico, and his father is an artist too, and that his father wanted to go to RISD, but the Rhode Island School of Design, but it didn't work out. And the sort of wonderful thing is that John, who's one of five of their children, John was able to get into RISD and, you know, become an artist. And so there's sort of a lovely, if you will, continuity, sort of shared, you know, a continuation, shall we say, between father and son. And I know from spending time with John and his family that they're a very loving and close-knit family. And so I think that there is definitely a lot of joy in having John's work shown here.
Yeah.
And the thing I would say is, you know, John is sort of at an emerging point in his career, and so this is his first large, if you will, small survey. I mean, you know, we're showing seven projects, but you know, we're attempting to survey a period of practicing in his work. This is the sort of first formal treatment that he's received. And so I think, though you may not have heard much about him to date, one of the things we like to do at the gallery is support the work of emerging artists. And so we hope that you'll probably hear a lot more about him in years to come.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, well, thank you so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Brooke. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much to Ian Alden Russell of the David Winton Bell Gallery at Brown University for telling us about the Works Well with Others exhibition, and David C. Gonzalez. And thank you to you for listening. I know I learned a lot. If you're in the Providence area, check out the gallery. If you're interested in having us promote your product or service, if you have a comment, if you have any ideas for future podcasts, or would like to be on the show yourself, please contact me at arttalkwithbrooke@gmail.com. That's all one word and Brooke with an E. Thanks for listening.
Let's Talk Art with Brooke is a Hotspur Enterprises media production.